Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, February 4th, 2024, is by Morgan Long on the topic of Quantum Mechanics is Not Magic.
So I'm going to ask, why is it important to understand quantum mechanics? We've all heard of quantum mechanics before, but why should we learn about it? Well, the first reason has to do with misinformation. There's a lot of scams involving quantum mechanics. There's a lot of scams involving quantum mechanics, from quantum healing to zero-point energy extraction to just tons of wrong things involving entanglement. And if you know some quantum mechanics, you can keep yourself safe from these scams. Second reason has to do with it's just better than all the scams. Reality is just more interesting. Every LED, laser, transistor, solar panel, they all are designed with quantum mechanics. Even less common technologies like superconductivity, quantum computing, quantum mechanics is essential. And then there's lots of just basic questions that are answered with quantum mechanics. Things like, why is the sky blue? What is radioactivity? Are just fundamentally quantum mechanical questions. Okay? All right. So now that I've established, we should totally learn about quantum mechanics. Let's start. Unlike most objects we interact with on a day-to-day basis, quantum particles are described by waves, specifically a wave function. I have a picture of one here. I might describe a particle constrained to one dimension, the x-axis. Note, unlike a chalice, it has spread to it. There's lots of places it kind of is, rather than one specific location. You may notice from the slide that a wave function uses complex numbers. I'm not going to talk about that anymore. I'm just going to say if you saw complex numbers in high school and wondered, who cares? This is one of the reasons why. So from the wave function, we can produce the probability density by squaring the wave function. And this function tells us the chance of finding a particle in a particular region. So the area in that region is the chance of finding the particle. So the chance of finding the particle from negative one-fifth to one-fifth is 59%, because this region in black here is 59% the total area under this curve. So what can we learn from this? Well, a wave function and probability density that is narrow restrains the space in which we can find a particle. Right? And a wide function, there's lots of places you could find the particle. So you might have heard of superposition before, and we can already see it in action here. So each place on this curve that isn't zero is a place the particle could be found, right? So the particle could be found here at zero, could be found here at minus two-thirds, but it could also be found at 0.1, 0.09. In fact, there's infinitely many places under this curve the particle could be found. And the particle is in a superposition of being in all of those places until you measure it. And in fact, every particle, because it's a wave, has spread to the wave. So every particle is in a superposition of position all of the time. It's not a weird property some particles have. Every particle is in a superposition. So, yep.
Just one question. You said it can't be at zero?
No, it could be at zero. Okay. Yes. I mean, the only place it can't be zero is, or can't be, is right there.
So I'm calling
a particle any quantum object. Certainly, an atom could be a quantum object. It could also be like, you know, an electron, like a part of an atom. There's even been some cases where you can get bigger systems. I think the largest system I saw that showed quantum behavior is like a really small sapphire. It's like below a micron in size, but it's enormous for a quantum system. It's still like billions of atoms. But it's still too small to see, but I'm using particle vaguely for this talk.
Okay. Thanks.
So in addition to the spread of a wave, there's another important property of waves, which is the wavelength. The wavelength is measured from identical parts of a wave, such as tip to tip or trough to trough. So this wave here has a wavelength of 2, because all those distances are all 2. Okay? So let's think about some people, and they're going to wiggle some ropes, okay? So this top wave up here, You know, it's nice and wiggled. There's lots of waves in it. And it has a well-defined wavelength, right? All these distances, if you measure it from identical parts, they all give you the same number. So we've got a nice wavelength here. This bottom wave here does not have a good wavelength. There's not even multiple waves to measure between, right? So you can only vaguely estimate a wavelength for it. However, this bottom wave has a well-defined position, right? It's right there at about 25. And this top wave is kind of in a lot of places. You know, there's not one place in specific this wave is. So if we apply this logic to waves in general, waves themselves don't have well-defined positions and well-defined wavelengths at the same time. This is just a regular rope wave thing. So why do we care about this in a quantum mechanics talk? Well, what we learned from de Broglie's equation is that the wavelength of a wave is related to the momentum of the particle. A higher wavelength means a lower momentum, and vice versa. So, if a wave can't have a well-defined position and wavelength, a particle can't have a well-defined position and momentum. And that is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So, delta x and delta p are the uncertainty in position and momentum, and h bar is a quantum constant. It's a really small number. So, this is one of the big mysterious things in quantum mechanics, and it's just waves. It's just waves. So some things to note about this inequality. First of all, it's an inequality. So you could have a wave with bad uncertainty in both position and momentum. It's totally valid. You could think of a wave with lots of peaks, and they're not spaced like consistently. They're just kind of all over the place. It's not good position or momentum. And the other thing is you can't know either of these exactly. Right? If either uncertainty is zero, this inequality is no longer true. So, common misconception, you can't know either one perfectly at all. All right. Let's see. Heisenberg. Okay. So position and momentum are examples of what we call observables in quantum mechanics. And when we measure an observable, we always get the same result after we measure it. So, for example, suppose we have this particle at the beginning of an experiment, and we measure its position. Maybe we find it's at zero. If we measure its position again, it will still be at zero. But if we now take a new particle with this same initial wave function and ask where it is, it might be at 0.1 this time. And measuring that particle will always give 0.1 for its location. So why do we always get the same result when we measure it? Well, when we measure a particle, the wave function changes. It collapses to a wave that always gives the same result. So when you measure position, the wave function becomes a really narrow spike right where you measured the position. So future results of the measurement never give a different answer. This is another reason you can't just measure momentum and position of a particle, because after you measure one of those, the wave function is just different now, and you're no longer measuring the same initial wave function you had before you measured the first property. Yep. Okay, so time for a big misconception time. A lot of people think quantum mechanics has something to do with consciousness. It does not. Measurement has nothing to do with consciousness. All you need to measure a particle is that a record of its state has to exist in the universe. That could happen if the particle collides with a detector, even if no one's looking at it, at the readout of the detector. It could also happen if the particle collides with an air molecule or thermal noise happens. Now, these are all ways to measure a particle without any person being involved. Okay? So I've talked a bit about probability at this point. You might think, okay, this probability stuff is nice. It's probably just like a sham, right? The particle existed somewhere. It had a momentum. We just didn't know what it was until we looked, right? If you thought that, you'd be in great company with quantum physicists like Einstein. Theories like that are called hidden variable theories. The idea is that there's some hidden variable we don't know about that's controlling all that stuff. And they're all wrong. They were disproven by the work of John Bell, and he showed that, no, in fact, observables aren't known until they are measured. Particles really are wave-like. So, in addition to position and momentum, let's talk about a third observable, which is energy. So when we measured position, we found we could only get certain values as dependent on the wave function. And this is still true for energy, except it's even more restricted by what the system is. So let's think about a classic physics problem for a moment, which is the harmonic oscillator. And think of the harmonic oscillator as a parabola and putting a ball in the parabola somewhere. We care about this system a lot because it approximates a lot of systems very well. A pendulum or a mass on a spring all exhibit harmonic oscillation. So it's a very classic example. So like I said, harmonic oscillation, you put a ball in the parabola. So if you put the ball in the middle, the ball doesn't go anywhere, right? There's no energy, so it just stays at the bottom there. Now, if you put the ball higher up here on the side, it's going to roll back and forth, right? But it's never going to go further from the center than when it started because it doesn't have enough energy to get further away. However, we can put the ball at any height to start, and any height is a totally reasonable place to put a ball, right? There's no weird limit on that. But if we construct a quantum harmonic oscillator, we see something interesting. Only certain energy values are allowed starting states. So here are the first handful. So we got E0 and up through a whole bunch. There's technically infinitely many. Can't draw infinitely many things, so we'll have to settle for 4. So that's interesting, right? There's only so many, and they're spaced apart from each other. Something to note here. This is the lowest energy state, E0. E0 is not zero energy, right? It's up here. It's not down here. So this means that if you make a quantum harmonic oscillator, the particle has to have some motion to it. And that fact is called zero-point energy. There's the lowest energy state has energy to it. That is a very common scam that people will claim they have a device that extracts zero-point energy and make infinite free power. And, anyone who says they have infinite free power is lying, but, that's especially true if they put the word quantum with it. So for each of these energy values, there's a special wave function associated with it. So that's what's going on in this next picture. We have the different energy levels from before, and now we've drawn the wave function associated with each energy. So something to note in this picture. Let's look at this bottom wave function here. Notice it extends outside of the parabola. So that means for that energy function, it's possible to find the particle somewhere it doesn't have enough energy to exist at. It's outside the parabola. It started higher up than where we put it. That fact is called tunneling. And particles can be found where they don't have enough energy to exist at or to go through a barrier they don't have enough energy to bypass. Tunneling is very important. I will say it's very sensitive to distance. The probability drops rapidly with distance, and it drops rapidly as the barrier increases. But it's relevant. So in a special kind of microscope called a scanning tunneling microscope, it uses that sensitivity to distance to very precisely measure really small things. It's also very relevant to nuclear fusion, like what powers the sun. Another interesting thing to note here, we have this bottom function. It's got a nice long wavelength. And up here at E7, it's a very short wavelength. It's much wavelier. And that's a consequence of de Broglie's equations, which say that a higher momentum corresponds to a lower wavelength. So this is a faster moving particle. It has more kinetic energy. So the wavelength is shorter. All right. So I've shown you these wave equations. The interesting thing about them is that you can take any wave equation, and by adding these together, you can produce that wave equation. And the portion that you need to do to form that bigger wave equation determines the probability of measuring a particular energy value. So for example, this top wave here is made up of equal parts psi0 and psi1, okay? The first energy state and the second energy state. Right? You can see it's just these two added together. And if we measure the energy, there's a 50% chance we measure E0 and a 50% chance we measure E1 because it's equal portions of both. And after we measure, if we measure E0, the wave function collapses to psi0. And if we measure E1, the wave function collapses to psi1. So this wave function up here is in a superposition of these two energy states. Note, it's still a superposition of infinitely many positions, okay? But it's also a superposition of two energy values. That's not a strange thing in this case. Technically, what the math side of measuring something means is that every observable has a bunch of functions that make every wave function. And then when you measure something, you break the function into all of its component wave functions for that observable, and the relative probability of each determines the chance of measuring it. So this wave function is a superposition of position, a superposition of momentum, a superposition of energy, and any other observable you want to measure. In fact, superposition is actually just like a math term for, it means add. You can add wave functions, and it gives you the nice property. That's literally what it's used for. It's not actually a weird word in science, but media really loves to stretch what superposition is as a weird idea. All right, so I'm going to mention atoms here real quick. So an interesting thing about atoms, the attractive force between electrons and protons grows infinitely as the distance shrinks. But electrons don't spiral into the nuclei of atoms. They stay further out. So why is that? Well, it's, again, zero-point energy. The lowest energy state has to have some energy to it, and so it stays out with some orbital energy. Now, if we look at the energy levels of hydrogen, which is the easiest atom, we get this diagram. So down here is the lowest energy state, and they get higher and higher energy. Up here at energy zero, that's where the electron is no longer attached to the hydrogen, and it just flies away. And so something to note here, the energy states get closer and closer together at higher energy values. That's very common in real quantum systems, because here at the macroscopic level, energy is perfectly subdividable. You can use any amount of energy, and you can use any portion of that energy. And so we expect that as the energy gets higher, the size of the energy units gets smaller to match what we experience in our day-to-day lives. So what can we get from this diagram? Well, each of these gaps between energy levels, which are shown by these arrows, is hydrogen. They're all named because it's easy. But the gaps between these energy levels correspond to a particular energy amount, which corresponds to a particular color of photon. And an electron can go between energy levels by emitting or absorbing a photon of that energy color. And this is how a neon light works. A neon light uses electricity to take the electrons to a higher level energy state, and then the electrons fall back down, and they emit a red photon when they do that. It's also how a fluorescent light works, except the mercury gas produces ultraviolet light, and the fluorescent coating converts that into visible light. So allowed states, like for energy, apply to more than just energy. Angular momentum has energy. The orbitals around an atom correspond to a particular amount of allowed angular momentum. In addition, certain particles, like the electron, have a property called spin. If you measure the spin of an electron, it either has a spin of 1/2 or minus 1/2, and not anywhere in between. Right? So there's only certain states we can get. And these allowed states are actually where the word quantum comes from. Quantum refers to an amount of something, or a quanta of it. And so finally, I'll mention entanglement. It's one of the most unique parts of quantum mechanics. Almost everything I've talked up to this point has an analogy with waves. And that's the beauty of quantum mechanics. It's all just waves. Entanglement is one of the few things that isn't just waves. And it's very important to the field, that proof of John Bell's theorem that disproves hidden variable theories. It relies on entanglement to be carried out. And it's a common application of scammers to just claim entanglement does whatever they want, right? No one needs to understand it if you're selling something. So I'm going to explain entanglement very briefly, and then I'll point you to a good source on the subject. So entanglement is when two particles, their wave function becomes, you can't understand either of them with just one particle's wave function. You need both. So for example, there's an unstable particle that when it decays, it produces an electron and an anti-electron, which is called a positron. And when it does that, they have opposite spins. So either the electron has 1/2 spin and the positron has minus 1/2 spin, or it's the other way around. And if you measure the electron spin and it has 1/2, you already know what the positron spin is. It's the opposite, right? So that's the core idea of entanglement. I highly recommend in the further reading section Chad Orzel's book, How to Teach Physics to Your Dog. It's a very beginner-friendly guide to physics. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to take them.